Maybe this bridge gate was just payback. It's a bitch slap to the state Democrats. We gotta get out, but we can't. We're stuck in Governor Chris Christie's Fort Lee, New Jersey traffic jam. Governor, let me in, I wanna be your friend. There'll be no partisan divisions. Let me wrap my legs round your mighty rims and relieve your stressful condition. You got Wall Street master stuck cheek to cheek with blue collar truckers, and man, I really gotta take a leak, but I can't, I'm stuck in Governor Chris Christie's Fort Lee, New Jersey traffic
You gotta love it. You gotta love it.
That's right.
I can't get my mind around the absolute, obvious, degenerate, opportunistic, sleazy behavior of New Jersey's governor.
Oh, I thought you had a few more adjectives than that.
Well, I ran out. I lack imagination at this hour. I can't use a lot of them, you know.
This show's really not about him.
No.
Well, but he's going to set up what the show's about.
Okay.
So, okay, tell us what he did.
Well, I don't know what he did, what he seems to have done. Well, let's be careful here. We don't want him suing us. It seems. Now, first of all, remember Chris Christie. He was the guy, big, fat guy.
Oh, that's irrelevant.
No, it isn't. It isn't irrelevant.
It's totally irrelevant.
We're going to have to argue about this because I actually think his body is symbolic of his mindset and of his power base and of his way of thinking and operating. Now, I know a lot of people are going to beat me up. A lot of people are going to beat me up here, you know. We don't go there.
Say overweight people are power-hungry, ambitious, and unscrupulous?
No, I did not.
You just said his body was
I did say that. That's the other way around. That is, the hour-grabbing hunger is his body. I'm going to say that.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that people who are overweight or people whose weight is in overweight may even be politically incorrect. People who are large are necessarily people who are aggrandizing, who are ambitious, who are blah, 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 blah. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is his body is symbolic of where his head is at. And that is what I'm saying. But let's not get hung up on that. Let's just understand that apparently, for reasons having to do, we now think, with enormous real estate deals in Fort Lee and Hoboken, New Jersey,
right,
in which there was not agreement by largely Democratic people in government, mayors particularly, a decision was made by Chris Christie's people to shut down all but a small amount of the lanes on the George Washington Bridge, the largest traffic bridge in the United States.
Yeah.
Four days.
We should be clear, though, that the Hoboken scandal we're talking about today may or may not be tied directly to that bridge closure.
That's true.
That bridge closure may be about another separate redevelopment deal.
But
we don't really know yet.
No, we won't know for a bit, but I think we will know because it's so gross, so incredibly gross. And we also have to flash back to the image of Chris Christie effectively exploiting the president during the incredible disaster of the hurricane.
Right.
And of them walking together man to man, you know, and looking at the damage. And gets along with this liberal so-called Democrat. And the Democrat gets along with this conservative Republican guy. And isn't that nice? Isn't that sweet?
Well, the way it was spun at the time was, well, here's two dudes putting aside their differences and working together in a time of obvious need. Right?
Yeah.
Right. But here's where it went south, if this report is to be believed. There's a block of land in Hoboken, New Jersey, just yes. across the Hudson River from Manhattan.
Yes.
Hurricane Sandy hit, and a large percentage of Hoboken was underwater. I don't know if you recall seeing that video footage of the water surging through the subway tunnel. That was Hoboken.
Yeah.
It was in bad, bad shape.
Right.
So there's a lot of money being doled out by the federal government for Hurricane Sandy relief. It made its way through the New Jersey governor's office. And allegedly, the New Jersey governor's office went to the city of Hoboken and said, well, we've got this hurricane relief money, but if you want it, you're going to have to green light this redevelopment project that we like.
Done by the Rockefeller
Group. The Rockefeller Group, which is a private equity real estate development. They're a developer.
Yeah. And a similar kind of deal at Fort Lee, which was not agreed to, also is the probable, we don't know for sure, the probable cause of the shutting down of the GW Bridge.
Right, which led, among other things, to at least one death because emergency services cannot reach somebody in time.
Right, and I got to tell people, if you're just tuning in, this is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris, and this is the Chris Christie Show.
Right, but the show is not about this scandal per se. What we want to do here is point out that this is the latest iteration in something that has come to be known as disaster capitalism.
Yes,
which is the exploitation of a natural or man-made disaster as an excuse to come in and radically realign the economic prerogatives in an area. This example was, do what we want, or we're not going to help you recover from this natural disaster.
Do what we want, or you will die.
Yes. Two of the more high-profile and egregious examples of this, also known as the shock doctrine after the wonderful book by Naomi Klein, was in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and in Iraq after the invasion by the United States.
Yeah, this is a persistent late-stage capitalism phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a reflection of the combination of political ambition and money.
Yeah.
Basically. And we're seeing this everywhere, and I wonder if we aren't seeing it, when I say everywhere, I mean, like, here? Oh, surely not, because we don't have any disasters, right?
Well, not yet. Not yet.
Yeah.
Of course, the twist on this is with the acceleration of global climate change, natural disasters are going to become more and more, they are becoming more and more common. So I suspect we'll see even more and more examples of this sort of opportunistic capitalism.
Well, and turning away from the concept of storm-driven opportunities, disaster-driven opportunities of this kind, if we go back in Portland history and we start looking at what happened to the neighborhood called Albina, which most of our listeners probably don't even remember, I don't know, which was a thriving black enterprise-driven neighborhood. Which was leveled by the Portland Development Commission with the albino, albina turned albino, which was leveled by plans to create a vast medical complex, which never quite materialized. And in that process, the black community was diffused, was spread about the city, was essentially, in terms of cultural life, destroyed. The jazz scene, the music scene in general that was predominantly black, disappeared. The whole area, housing, much of it in single-family housing, purchased at an advantage by the Portland Development Commission, people's homes torn down, those people spread throughout the city. We now see larger black communities in the outskirts of the city.
How is this an application of the shock doctrine?
Well, it was, the idea was that this neighborhood was so awful, the housing was so decrepit, that we had to renew it. Now, this was not due to a natural disaster, but it was due to an argument made essentially in several neighborhoods in Portland that they were so awful, that they were such terrible, terrible derelict areas that they had to be torn down and something else, highly profitable, had to be put in their place.
Hmm.
And, you know, I look at the doctrine, I try to widen out my understanding of it, because it isn't always based. I understand the shock doctrine being based on terrible events making an opportunity for capital to exploit. But beyond that, terrible conditions perceived by the middle to upper class or white establishment requiring an immediate intercession by government and private enterprise, which ends up benefiting private enterprise with the support structure. And we see that all over the country with urban development, with an effort to modernize the cities. And that is, I think, a logical extension of the same idea. All of it designed, and this is the primary point, to benefit wealthy real estate holders.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the deal.
Yep, that is the deal. Should we take a phone call?
Yeah, let's take a phone call.
Who do we have? Ed, good morning.
Hello. Good morning, guys.
Hey.
Hi. You know, I think you could make a strong comparison between what Chris Christie was doing and what the Tea Party was doing when they wanted to unfund the government to affect Obamacare. And I think it really it just basically says we don't care how the regular people get hurt as long as we get what we want.
Yeah,
and I think that applies to what Chris Christie did. He didn't care very much, or well, I mean, whether he was involved or not, I guess that we'll.
Well, that remains to be seen. The evidence is pretty strong so far, but we don't know.
Yeah, exactly. But obviously, the people that shut down the bridge or closed those lanes didn't really care about the consequences of the people in the street, in the traffic jam, the kids, the people that were sick and needed emergency services. So,
well, and apparently, and apparently one of the people in the Christie camp said essentially about the school kids stuck on the buses, doesn't matter, their parents vote Democratic. These are potential Democrats.
But right. So my main point is that they don't really have a lot of concern for the people that they actually put them in office or that they're supposed to represent.
No, you're right. You're right. Thank you for
that. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call. You know, I was Engineer Steve just handed me something really good in this same area. The Mount Tabor Reservoir event. Remember, Mount Tabor Reservoir, somebody peed in it. Therefore, it was dangerous. You know, back in 1970, there was a rumor that LSD was going to be put in it. So they put guards around it. With open reservoir.
That
deadly.
Actually happened. No, that didn't. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
The LSD didn't. Well, no. Maybe it didn't. We don't know. We're all crazy.
So. And continue, please.
Anyway, the thing is that the argument about closing the reservoirs makes an assumption of a potential disaster, a disaster so enormous that it requires a radical and very expensive effort to either cover the reservoirs or create new covered reservoirs and merely use those as kind of like reflecting ponds or something. And this is an enormous advantage to the construction industry and the real estate industry. And it is actually the fear of this inevitable, I put quotes around that, debacle, this inevitable disaster, is what is fueling this huge change in the water system. If you are paying attention, and most of you must be, your water bills have risen and risen.
Oh, indeed they have.
And risen. And all the reason for this has to do with these projects to prevent or to ameliorate disasters. And they are public-private partnerships, inevitably. I just wanted to bring that one up. Another example going way back into the 1960s was the War on Poverty Opportunities for Model Cities here in Portland, which is where, in fact, the Albina neighborhood was torn down. But part of Model Cities was an appraisal of all the housing in Portland. And the decision was made to begin that process with the hippie neighborhood, with the bohemian neighborhood of Lair Hill, rather than other neighborhoods that could have been reasonably essayed. So we know that this is a political weapon, even here in little old Portland, Oregon.
Indeed it is. And perhaps the most glaring example of this doctrine, the shock doctrine, the doctrine of economic opportunism in the wake of disaster, is after the September 11th attacks, 2001.
Oh, yeah.
A whole new department of the federal government was created.
Mm-hmm.
Billions of dollars in no-bid contracts were handed out both here to enforce this new security state that was foisted upon us in the wake of a disaster, and in our new fiefdom, in our new province in Iraq, billions and billions of dollars given away without any proper review, without the regular contractual process.
Yeah, big pallets of $100 bills.
Yeah, like $1 billion in shrink-wrapped cash went missing.
Yay!
And it's in my basement. How'd that happen? Let's go to the phones. Brian, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Boy, you guys are spreading all over the place this morning.
Oh, well, you know.
Oh, that's good, though. So
laser focus around here.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on, the tearing down of black neighborhoods and all. That's happened all over the country. And,
yeah.
You know, Harlem, East St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you read some of the biographies of, like, Miles Davis, and you see East St. Louis at one time was an incredibly thriving place of the black community, and they had their own banks and et cetera, their own stores. And now it's a scary place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to drive in and out of, and you know, and it's actually better than it was of just a few years ago. But I think it's become our culture to once a struggling people, you know, certain people, and black people being definitely one of them, start getting ahead, it's like, let's just take it down. And it's done through laws and improvements. And I think the biggest joke now is putting a Trader Joe's in a food desert. they're labeling it a food desert, and they're putting a Trader Joe's in there.
Where are you referring to?
That's up by Alberta and Martin Luther King.
Yeah. Alberta and Martin Luther King, exactly.
And we're financing it.
Well,
why not? If it really was a food desert, which it's not. You'd put a Winco in there or a QFC. You wouldn't put a Trader Joe's in a food desert.
Well, Trader Joe's sells food, right?
They are very there because it's mostly luxury food, as we all know, anybody who's been there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get into a discussion of Trader Joe's, but I do think that your point overall is valid. A lot of money, tax rebates and so on, take place in the creation of these stores that are designed to solve a real problem, which is neighborhoods that don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables, don't have decent meat counters and so on. So it is a model of slow disaster, of slow disaster capitalism. And I think your point has a lot of validity to it. I don't know that there's an intentional evil on the part of, for example, Whole Foods or New Seasons or Trader Joe's, which is a big West Coast operation, and Whole Foods even larger. I don't know that is a deliberate effort on their part. I think it's a part of a culture. A largely capitalist culture, well, totally capitalist culture, which interfaces government in support of private enterprise and is justified by the fact that it will provide a service which is otherwise not available.
Right. You definitely said it better than I could.
Pay me the huge bucks to be on the air here on KU.
I honestly think that in this tearing down of communities, especially black communities, there's a pronounced and unsaid but quite obvious racial element to it, and I think we need to call our leaders on that, whether it's in Portland or anywhere in the country.
But yeah, I see it less as about racism at this point in history than it is about people who are poorer versus more wealthy and more powerful communities.
Oh, I see racism as,
well,
as
okay.
obvious.
You know? I think we can agree to disagree on that one.
All right, and you guys have a great day.
Yeah, thanks,
hey, thanks
a lot for the
call.
Okay, bye.
This question of this new grocery store development at Alberta and MLK is an interesting one because it is yet another example of the myth of the purity of the free market being dispelled. I mean, if there is a market need to put a food store in that location, capitalist dogma tells us that somebody will rise up and do that, right? The invisible hand will magically put a grocery store there, right?
Right.
And they should do it of their own free will because that's what the market wants and there's a profit in it for them. But as we're seeing here, it's not happening without substantial support from government.
Well, that has become the custom. Now, remember that there was a Fred Meyer at Killingsworth, a huge Fred Meyer at Killingsworth and Martin Luther King previously, and there is a Safeway at Ainsworth.
Yeah, there is.
And MLK. So what we're really seeing here is a pattern where there's a good deal. It's a good deal for any developer. And that deal is not available to a small grocer.
No.
It's only available to those who can afford to put together the money that it takes to put together, in turn, a large operation. So it is a kind of disaster, a slow-moving disaster capitalism.
Or maybe just an old-fashioned shakedown.
Yeah, you know.
All right, who's next, Steve?
Barth.
What's
it's
up?
Me. Good morning.
Hello.
Briefly on the grocery store issue, there is a Whole Foods that's already in that neighborhood that hasn't been there very long, a few years.
I would
know there's one right on MLK or on Interstate.
No, it's at Interstate and Ainsworth. It's a new season.
That's kind of right in the same area that's providing a similar sort of service.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
but I think the gripe here, just to be real simplistic, is that the city and the development commission wants to subsidize this to the tune of $500,000 in terms of the real estate, et cetera, to mm-hmm. produce and construct this store, which is not greatly changing the ability of local people to buy decent food at a fair price.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think you're overall you're correct. I think really. What we're looking at in Portland is the change, a big change taking place all over the city, not necessarily having to do with race, but having to do with income. We're seeing the city become a privileged and upper middle class and so on. The same pattern, by the way, that you can see in San Francisco or the Berkeley area. And this pattern essentially excludes working poor people from access to these services because the cost of housing becomes prohibitive and people have to move to the outskirts of town.
Right, but well, this is a pretty circular argument.
Yeah, it
in
is.
This particular case, but one of the things that you brought up was disaster capitalism.
Yes.
Per se, one of the kind of poster children of that is Haiti.
Yes, absolutely.
And we can thank Bill Clinton for really sticking it to the locals in terms of making deals and cutting the minimum wage so that Western businesses and exploitive locally owned but upper crust persons can construct commercial operations down there to exploit the locals' labor and then to import the profits into the upper, 1% mm-hmm. again. The timing of that, I think, also kind of reflects similar moves across the country where there was a kind of quiet but concerted effort to dissipate energy among the black populace, where they were getting organized, where they were having financial success, where they were building community, and that there was some fear in the upper echelons of paranoia, like J. Edgar Hoover, that these would provide bases that would then inevitably tilt toward black power slash communism slash Muslim dissipation of white power. I think that may be simple enough to grasp.
You're saying from the perspective of the white establishment, not only did displacing a traditional African-American neighborhood, not only did that reap dividends for the investors in this particular medical complex project, but it had the added bonus of diffusing a sort of a center of mass for political power.
Yes. And I think that model was replicated elsewhere in the country, where lots of freeways were plowed through mostly middle class and lower class areas, at an area that was trying to get on its feet more and make like the Black Panthers with breakfast. And I'm kind of a little dissipated here myself. The self-help operations that were bringing pride and maximizing educational and financial opportunities in areas that were primarily low income and racially segregated areas back in the late 60s and early 70s, that there was a lot of pressure from the white establishment to drop the hammer on these with COINTELPRO and a lot of other things, but also with urban renewal money, quote unquote, and grants or not grants for infrastructure and changes that went on that supported the white power base, that supported a relatively narrow swath of the white power base, and dissipated the energy again of organizing and cohesion in minority communities.
Well, I think your point, particularly about the dissipation of cohesion or the dissipation of possibilities of locally based successful projects is really very important. I want to let you go, because I want to talk a little bit about the Rockefeller Group.
Thank you for the call.
Good day.
Yeah. I think it's important to understand that these projects are massive projects.
Yes.
The Rockefeller Center, which began really in the 30s, which was properties owned by the Rockefeller family, developed into this huge place where NBC is located, and in fact where Fox News is located now is, right, and all these high, modern, very attractive buildings. That name was taken by a group of developers who bought most of those properties and built many, many more modern skyscrapers in that location and changed the nature of that neighborhood from being a housing for relatively wealthy people, but not super wealthy people, into a huge business, white-collar class neighborhood. Companies involved are international. Mitsubishi is a major player in it. Time Incorporated, Time Warner, is involved in these properties. I mean, beginning back in 1959, Commonwealth and many, many other. Tisher is one of the main holders now of that company. These are big, big, big development companies that escape usually, unless you're involved in looking at real estate in the New York Times or something, and you don't even know about these things. And these are the players who are involved in the vast effort to revitalize, I use their terminology, places like Hoboken. And these projects are part of a political power base that can give success or failure to someone like Chris Christie.
So the Rockefeller Group, of course, is the interest that coveted this piece of land in Hoboken.
Exactly.
And who is allegedly behind this shakedown, saying, give us this land to redevelop, mm-hmm. or you will receive no Hurricane Sandy relief funds, Hoboken,
well,
New Jersey.
It's not clear. I want to make this point. It's not clear that the Rockefeller Group has anything to do with the shakedown. The Rockefeller Group is essentially expecting a deal from whatever government, whoever is in power in New Jersey. And
well,
the shakedown
they're
comes
tacit
in
benefactors, right?
Right.
Right.
But the shakedown comes in when the Republican dominated government of Chris Christie mm-hmm. is able to control the monies that would allow the project to be built. So they can simply say, well, you will do thus and so, and the price of it will be supporting our boy.
Right.
And that's what's happening. And it's the most kind of primitive city politics that you can imagine.
Almost a character of New Jersey politics, isn't it?
Well,
East Coast
yeah.
politics.
We expect it. We expect
yeah,
it
we do.
Because we have stereotyped notions about it. And we find it kind of charming in a way, not so much so.
No, I don't find it charming at all.
But here it is. Here it is. And we're all going, oh, this can't be. This can't be as obvious as this. Well,
it is pretty damn obvious. Isn't it?
Yeah, it would amaze me if it turned out that the Christie forces and the Christie interests and the modern Republican party were not directly involved.
And this is the great Christie. It's the great reasonable Republican moderate, right, who could reach across the aisle and stand a legitimate shot of winning the presidency.
Well, yeah.
Because he's so moderate and even-handed.
And in fact, an arch conservative.
In fact, an arch conservative.
So we're seeing it's not just disaster capitalism. It goes beyond that conceptual framework to a process of steady state advance of capitalism, Rockefeller Center to this potential project in Hoboken and all over the country. More and more very valuable real estate is developed by these singularly wealthy, well-off corporate holders with the support through tax abatements and so on, by governments.
Yes.
And that becomes inevitably a political plum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're seeing in New Jersey, and that's what we're seeing everywhere. And I would suggest that one ought to be asking questions about development in the Portland metro area in the same context. It's less gross. It's less obviously party-based. But, hey, you know, the question is who's doing what with whom and who ends up benefiting.
Cui bono.
Ah.
Who benefits?
Ooh, Latin.
Latin.
That must make it true. All right, let's hear from you. 231-8187. We're talking about the Christie debacle and disaster capitalism and land development in the United States. Lynn.
What's up?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Say, against all odds, you guys actually got me thinking this morning.
Oh,
hey!
No. Oh, no.
Sorry,
no.
It won't happen again.
And where the, well, I hope so. And where this sort of led me is to question the whole, I mean, not to question Naomi Klein's work. I think she has great insights. I think it's all true. But I wonder if there's how much difference there is between capitalism, just, you know, the regular capitalism, and so-called disaster capitalism. Maybe all capitalism is disaster capitalism.
Well, you know, in a way, this is probably my argument more than Abe's. In a way, I think you're right.
I would disagree.
Okay.
Well,
please continue.
Let me give some examples of broadening this out a
okay.
little bit.
Sure.
Okay. One, you may not have caught national business news. We've had this huge and ongoing wave of foreclosures.
Yes.
Of people who bought these rigged mortgages.
Yes.
Well, what is happening, at least in some of the real ground zeros of that area, such as Florida, Arizona, California, is there are whole cities or whole neighborhoods where those have all been bought up by investors who are now renting them out. So one bunch of bankers gets rich off of scamming the mortgages, and then another bunch is now going to be making it off of renting the same properties to people. Okay.
Well,
but of course, as many people find out the hard way, it seems, being a landlord isn't all that easy. It requires, you know, some actual work and knowledge what you're doing, and these bankers don't have it. And so I think much hilarity will ensue from that.
Well, I think taking part of your point it is clear that in the Great Recession, as they call it, is that we've seen a transfer of property, that is wealth in land, from small landholders, people typically with 100 by 100 foot or 50 by 100 foot lots with a house on it, transfer of that property from them to the banking community, which then will eventually turn that property over and make a vast profit, and it will be developed by large developers who have lots and lots of money. And that is a pattern that I see happening, which will mean that fewer and fewer Americans will be owning their own homesteads.
Yeah. And of course, we just heard this, what just happened in Washington with the machinists and Boeing, where Boeing basically made this threat of saying, play our way or we'll take our money and go someplace else.
Right.
And the state government, including the governor, just totally jumped all over it, gave them extra tax benefits because, you know, Boeing is so poor, they, you know, they can't be expected to pay regular taxes. And, of course, right here in our own little year, the governor's lovely gift to Nike.
Yeah, to Nike and Intel. Yes, these are examples of what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yes, but they're not examples of disaster capitalism.
Yeah. Hey, to bring it back to the local government involvement, now Nike has made this, or Mr. Knight has made this matching grant offer to OHSU, and they are going, OHSU is going to the legislature saying, hey, give us 200, what is it, 200 million, 200 billion, who the hell knows? Sooner or later, you're talking real money. But, you know, at the same time, the teachers are having to fight tooth and nail just to have some kind of a living. And that's the teachers, much less anybody else.
Yeah, so, no, I think overall, I probably agree with you more than Abe, because Abe really is focusing in on and sees the significance of the way in which disaster is manipulated. Not the disaster itself, but the post-disaster is manipulated to the interests of monopoly capital. But
one more thing?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was very briefly for a few weeks homeless several years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm not an expert on homelessness from that, believe me. But there was one thing I learned, and I couldn't believe I was so dumb, I'd never seen it before. But in this city, and I'll bet in every city, at least in this country, and I'll bet in almost every country, nothing is more important than that people who have land can make money off it.
Well, I certainly wouldn't disagree with that. You don't have to be homeless to see that. But your point is valid, and I want to thank you for the call.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Yeah, we just described a bunch of examples of government being inappropriately cozy with big business.
Well, I don't even know that not everybody would say it's inappropriate.
No, not everybody would. It really depends on which side of the divide you're on, I suppose, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, but I think that is reprehensible, certainly, and widespread, certainly, but I see that as distinct from this notion of disaster capitalism and the shock doctrine that we're describing.
Well, I think you're right, except that I think that when you start expanding the way in which it's operated, I think, for example, the Albina Renewal Project was essentially shock doctrine behavior. I think you don't have to have a natural disaster.
No.
You create a disaster. You say, oh, the housing here is so awful. People need to paint their houses. Let's tear it down. The hippies are out of control. That neighborhood is all rental properties. Let's tear it down. And these are examples, how capital is able to manipulate the real estate market to its interest by essentially making the other out of black people or long-haired hippies or poor people, working class people, whatever.
Okay. Yes. I still see a line there.
Yeah.
Look at New Orleans, for example. New Orleans was a majority black city, a major U.S. city, a cultural capital in so many ways. Hurricane Katrina comes along in 2005, and now New Orleans is no longer a majority black city. In the wake of that storm, when people, mostly poor people of all stripes, fled the city because it was flooded, mm-hmm. There were a series of applications of the shock doctrine there. Private housing was condemned. Contracts were let to large, wealthy, out-of-state firms to come in and redevelop areas after privately owned housing was
condemned. Well, in fact, public housing
was shut down. Yeah, this is all illustrated to great effect in the wonderful HBO show Tremé. If you want to see the nuts and bolts of how this really works in a very effective sort of medium, but this is what we're talking about. sort of like operating under the fog of war, almost. When it's some, there is chaos and there is confusion. That's when this shock doctrine is applied. That's when massive changes are able to be put into effect with little or no deliberation and little or no recourse for those who are on the short end of things.
Well, I think you're right. But I also think at the same time that what happens is you can manufacture the sense of disaster, the sense of imminent disaster, the sense that the tax base is not as big as it could be, then therefore we have to move on it.
Oh, yeah. The whole Department of Homeland Security is evidence of that, isn't it?
I think so. And I think the whole urban renewal movement largely is evidence of that.
Let's go back to the phones.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Great show as always. I have a slogan which Chris Christie will not use in his 2016 presidential run.
I don't think he gets to run. But anyway, go ahead.
Let's get America moving again.
You're absolutely right.
Chris Christie, like a bridge over troubled water.
There you go. Anyways, I would like to say, in my opinion, the biggest expenditure related to the Portland Water Bureau recently, I thought, is the big pipe.
Yeah.
You know, that's not disaster capitalism. That's something that had to be done, and that might be one of the reasons why the water bills have been going up.
Well, that's true.
It is one of the reasons, yes.
You know, I have to tell you that I was the guy who wrote the big article about the coming big pipe in the Oregonian. The Oregonian newspaper was ignoring it until I did a piece for them in their op-ed pages. Big piece.
Well,
so I'm proud. I'm proud. I just like to
appreciate your wisdom.
I like to toot my horn here.
I'll toot along with you when you pass it over to me. But anyways, also, the last thing I have to say is the prices in Trader Joe's are really low. They have good prices.
Yeah, I didn't think the demonization of any of these stores makes any real sense. I think the question is there a collusive element in the development market and in the kickback of tax, in terms of tax abatements and so on?
And the answer is yes.
And I think there is that. But that's just, you know, here's the irony of it, business as usual.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Now, I got to jump back here and take issue with something you and a caller were in agreement about a few callers ago.
Go ahead.
And that is where you said, you brought up the notion of, isn't all capitalism at its heart disaster capitalism? Well, no. The answer is no.
Oh.
You know, some dude who sees a demand for widgets and starts making widgets and makes profit is simply a capitalist, not necessarily.
But what if he gets particularly significant loans or tax forgiveness or whatever to make his widgets because it's going to bring jobs to the community?
Well, that's another question.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. But
But it ain't disaster capitalist.
No, it ain't disaster capitalist.
Which is your point.
That is my point.
We agree on that.
Yeah. But, you know, widget maker observes a hurricane wiping out a major American city, sees a whole bunch of formerly private land condemned and put up at auction at pennies on the dollar. He swoops in, buys that land, sets up a factory, and hires immigrant workers to work at pennies on the dollar. Yes. Well, then he's a disaster capitalist, isn't he?
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Who's next? Brian, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I had a couple points I wanted to make. To the Trader Joe's issue, I think one of the big issues there is also that it's the development would be going to an out-of-state operation, and it's like there's no Portland developers that could do that project. Whatever you think about Trader Joe's and the fact that it really isn't a food desert around there, but the other thing is about disaster capitalism. I read Naomi Klein's book some years ago. And one of the things that became clear was that shocks come in all kinds of forms, and they're not always they don't always look like disasters. For example, the Olympics, or like when they defeated apartheid in South Africa, there was a big celebration, but the big money took that opportunity to sneak away a lot of money and resources. So disasters don't always look like disasters. And the third one thing I wanted to say was. As a small farmer myself, you see the use of government regulations whenever there's an outbreak of foodborne illnesses. The quote experts get together and come up with these solutions that are onerous to the small producers, and it's hard to imagine that there isn't some thought behind it. It's like as you see local agriculture kind of get a foothold, they're gonna the big ag is going to use whatever means they can to put their thumb on it. And you see that coming in the form of regulations that small producers can't, you can't hermetically seal your spinach field, But a big operation might be able to do that, or in some of the other regulations that they put forth. So that's something for people who are interested in local agriculture. Pay attention, because it does seem sometimes that they're making great strides in trying to put their thumb on that and make it where it's not really an option.
Well, and I think your point is good. I just wanted to mention one thing in the context of this. We are also seeing, and have for several years now, since the 1970s really, late 60s, we've seen the rise of cooperative grocery stores. We've seen it in People's Food Store and a bunch of these stores around Portland. We also see the capitalist development of New Seasons, which is definitely local, definitely trying to buy local, definitely trying to operate locally. So it isn't. It isn't a case of black and white. What it is really is shades of gray, shades of opportunity. And it does need to be made, and I think Abe's really making an important point. We really need to distinguish between true disaster capitalism and the inevitable and inexorable advance of capitalism per se.
Right. Well, what I was just bringing up was seeing the movement in government regulations towards regulations that may look like a solution to mm-hmm. the untrained eyes, mm-hmm. like, oh, that's a good move. You know, we had this outbreak of salmonella or whatever, you know, so yeah, this sounds like, but if you know anything about biology, if you know anything about growing, you know that these are often ridiculous solutions. They're not solutions. They're designed to make it so that they can get another, they can put the thumb on the small growers. And I don't know, that just seems like another form of disaster capitalism. And it does seem like another example of where our regulatory agencies have been kind of sold to the highest bidders. And, you know, I grew up thinking, you know, I believe in regulation. I believe the government should have a place in controlling pollution and controlling these things to get out of hand, you know. But now I see how oftentimes they have been taken over. I look at Vilsack and control the Department of Agriculture, who's Monsanto connections. You know, so you see where our regulations are no longer necessarily designed to do good for the most people.
Well, I think you're making an important point. And I think particularly in terms of the whole natural foods movement, the whole organic foods movement, there is a developing pattern which tends to favor the use of a massive chemicalization of agriculture. And I really appreciate your point, too.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. All right, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, an alternative radio journalist and author Robert McChesney speaks on the internet, capitalism, and democracy. At 10 here, Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring updates on the case of prisoner Russell Schoetz, calls for clemency for Edward Snowden, and a new report on how Henry Kissinger gave the green light for Argentina's dirty war.
You know, that last item is really important for people to understand. The role which our government played in the murderous behavior of the generals in Argentina.
You can hear that at 10:15 today.
Okay.
Also, a look at the new book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. At 11 on stage and studio host D.M.A. Roberts speaks with Nicole Lane, director of the Fertile Ground Citywide Festival of New Work, and with Fertile Ground executive director / founder Bruce Livingston and Passamart
Theater. I know Bruce Livingston. I went to school with Bruce Livingston.
Yeah, I know Bruce too.
Yeah.
And with director J. Austin Williams of American King Umps.
Umps.
King Umps.
Umps.
I don't know what that means.
I have no idea.
And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews artist Bonnie Meltzer about her show Coal, Not in Any Backyard. Artist and environmental activist Meltzer will talk about how her work relates to the plans to ship coal by train and barge coast and on.
Comes back as pollution.
Hey!
All right, we're talking today. We're using Chris Christie and the George Washington Bridge shutdown and the blackmail, really, seems so, mm-hmm. blackmail of the Christie administration to force cities to city leaders to support Christie, create an idea that somehow Chris Christie is the bipartisan candidate for president, which has sort of, I think it's imploding.
And you've also postulated that somehow Christie's largeness is an external indication of his internal demons. His drive for power.
I'm not going to support that position.
You stated it at the beginning of the show.
I know, but I just believe it. But it's like believing in God. You know, you can't really defend it.
Wow. All right, who's next? Gareth, good morning.
Hi.
Well,
I actually have this idea that perhaps what is our own poverty is an ongoing disaster that seems to be manipulated on a regular basis.
Mm.
And one of the things that I've seen in Portland, as well as just all over the United States, is that companies whose only real reason for existing is to own everything and rent it to us, are buying up distressed homes by the thousands so that they can just fix them up and rent them to us.
Yeah, no, that's really happening. That is really happening. That's for sure true.
And home ownership is almost impossible these days. You know, wages are going down, the houses are disappearing off the market, getting sucked into a corporate black hole. But I actually had an idea, and I was hoping more people could perhaps join me on this, in emailing our senators. They're talking about increasing the federal minimum wage, and I see that as pointless if the increase is a set dollar amount. What we actually need is the average price of a 20-year mortgage on an average two-bedroom house multiplied by 3 or 4 to be the minimum wage, and have it compounded quarterly, so that no matter how much prices go up, no matter what the price fluctuates for the housing market, it will always be possible to afford a mortgage and buy a home.
Well, it's an interesting idea. The other approach would be at the other end. That is, you'd have price stabilization in the marketplace. But I think it's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, prices will fluctuate, and it'll always be argued that it's unconstitutional to lock the price of a particular item. But it is not unconstitutional to lock minimum wage to the prices. And there we can get around that legal argument.
Hmm. That's interesting. I'll have to think a little bit on that.
Well, thank you. That's a very provocative phone call.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Let's get a few more in here before the end.
Okay.
Who's next, Steve? Harry, good morning.
Greetings, one and all.
Oh, yes.
Yes. My opinion is the Great Recession was caused by Hurricane Katrina. A whole city was destroyed. 100 years before, when San Francisco had their earthquake, a year later, what happened? We had economic disaster. And our recession, our Great Recession that we're going on right now is still continuing. What happened was, everyone forgot about what happened to Detroit. The whole city of Detroit was destroyed. All the companies, it used to be Motor City. Well, now Chrysler is the only one that's there.
I'm going to have to disagree with you here. I don't think that the destruction of New Orleans caused the recession. The recession was caused by the financial sector turning the economy into a giant casino and losing.
Yeah, but it costs so much money to government resources to rebuild New Orleans that it dried up all the capital.
Well, I have to jump in too. I actually don't agree with that. The availability of capital is pretty great. I think that the prime cause of the Great Recession was essentially a Ponzi scheme by the banking community, and there is indeed involvement by real estate interests. I think that disaster capitalism is a different phenomenon than what you're talking about, though I can see why you see the relationship.
Yes, and sure, it would take a year or two, but it did. It took all the resources away that they couldn't, and it exposed it. But another disaster that happened, what happened here in the Northwest, Mount St. Helens. You have to remember, when Mount St. Helens blew up, between 1980 and 85, river traffic up in the Columbia completely stopped.
Yeah, that's true.
Dredged. And that was the only time in Oregon history where our our population actually went down.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but I don't quite buy the argument. But I do appreciate the point, and I think that we tend not to examine adequately the interrelationship between events, natural events, and the phenomena of the market.
Well, I can prove my point is what happened to Hurricane Sandy. Okay, it had the results has not reached the economy yet. I mean, over 500,000 people were displaced. There was $61 billion worth of damage and counting.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say in 3 years we're going to have another economic crisis because of this.
Mm. Okay. Well, I think it's an interesting point. I'm going to let it go at that. I thank you for the call.
Oh yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah.
Gino, what's up?
Hi. On the real estate issue.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to blame the banks, but I bought my first house when I was 22. And when I bought that house, you had to have 20% down, so you had skin in the game. Today, you don't have to do that. It's the people's fault as much as the banks. They're signing up for loans they cannot afford. And the gentleman who called before, who talked about minimum wage was never designed to feed a family. It was designed as an entry-level job wage. If you want to earn more, you need greater skills.
Well, there you have it.
Well, yeah, we've run out of time. No time to respond.
Poor working folks don't deserve to have families.
Well,
you heard it here
first. You didn't. You're jumping to. Never mind.
Oh, I think that's where that line of reasoning was going.
Yeah. All right. We're really glad that you all listened to us. We hope to keep on doing the same with the shows that are coming up on here on KBOO. Remember, this is the only progressive radio station in the region.
From the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Tune in Tuesday night at 6.
Out Loud celebrates and serves the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, and allied communities.
Out Loud features interviews with local and national community groups, authors, musical talent, and anyone from the queer community.
Connect with us online at kboo.fm/outloud. Tune in Tuesday at 6 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on alternative radio, journalist and author Robert McChesney speaks on the internet, capitalism, and democracy. At 10, here are Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder, featuring updates on the case of prisoner Russell Schoetz, calls for clemency for Edward Snowden, and a new report on how Kissinger gave the green light for Argentina's dirty war. Also, a look at the new book, Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D. May Roberts speaks with Nicole Lane, director of the Fertile Ground Citywide Festival of New Work, and with Fertile Ground Executive Director, Founder, Bruce Livingston and Passing Art Theater, and with director Jane Austen Williams of American King Umps. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews artist Bonnie Meltzer about her show, Coal, Not in Any Backyard. Artist and environmental activist Meltzer will talk about how her work relates to the plans to ship coal by train and barge from Montana to the Pacific Coast and on to China. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? Become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now here's Alternative Radio.
Capitalism and the internet right now, it doesn't seem like the most healthy marriage. It doesn't seem like we're getting the results we need for a free and democratic society. That seems to be a problem. And maybe this is a time we should rethink our whole nature of our political economy. Maybe this is actually a notion to say the great promise of the internet, of egalitarian society and informed citizenry, that is something we should fight for. But the barrier to it, the impediment to it, is this political economy, this capitalist system.
That's Robert McChesney, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robert McChesney on the Internet, Capitalism, and Democracy. Remember the information superhighway and all the hype about the Internet? The wonders of the digital age would be liberating. A utopian bliss was at hand. Now it sometimes looks more like a dystopia. A handful of monopolies dominate the Internet. Google garners 97% of the mobile search market. Microsoft's operating system is used by 90% of the world's computers. Capitalism has colonized cyberspace, spurred the collapse of journalism, independent bookstores, and many, many jobs. The sharp decline in antitrust enforcement of violations, the increase in patents on technology and proprietary systems, and massive subsidies have turned large parts of the Internet into an electronic shopping mall. And worse, it has become an unparalleled apparatus for government and corporate surveillance, thus further eroding democracy. Activists are attempting to reclaim the democratizing potential of the Internet before the door slams shut. To talk about these issues is Robert McChesney. He's co-founder of Free Press, a nonprofit organization working to increase public participation in media policy debates. He's professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of numerous books, including Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and Digital Disconnect. He spoke in Amherst, Massachusetts. And now, Robert McChesney.
The first thing you want to do when you look at a communication technology as profound as the Internet is sort of get a sense of where it fits into the broad panorama of technological revolutions, communication technological revolutions. I mean, is it similar to radio or television? And I would say that it's greater than radio and television. I would say it's clearly a notch above that in terms of its social impact. And in many respects, the real debate we're going